the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 439 for Wednesday, the 4th of March, 2015. I'm Dave Neal, returning to the show this week, fresh off a night shift, so forgive me if I sound a little bit groggy and a little bit distant at times, although some of you maybe think that's probably normal anyway for the show. Joining me in the wilds of the Canterbury, Harry Lloyd and I, back on the show for the first time since we went down to the XL. Harry, hello, mate. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. Enjoying some slight English sun as I peer through the gap in my curtains. So maybe after this I'll be able to walk to the shops and not have to wear a ski jacket, which would be quite nice for a change.
We're heading the right way, you know. The nights are getting lighter and the mornings are getting a little bit lighter, especially when doing the shift work. You can see that I go to work now with no lights on my bike and everything's heading towards race season.
Yep,
I'm certainly loving it. It's my favourite time of year. I like it in springtime.
Yep, it would be good if we could have some racing instead of just testing, but just a couple more weeks to wait. So
yeah, not so much. We're in the right month for it. We're in MotoGP month, aren't we? We've only got a couple of weeks now, and the boys will be out and girls will be out at Qatar.
Yep.
So it is upon us, mate. It is upon us.
Exactly. So I think it's something like 20 days or so, as we're recording this, till we're under the floodlights at Qatar. So can't wait for that. There's a lot to talk about, as we'll get to in the show. We've had our final Sepang test. Now it's just the Qatar test, which luckily we will have Martin Darlington on the ground making his Motopod return in a big way at the test. So be sure to look forward to that, everyone.
Excellent news. Look forward to seeing what Martin can bring back from that. It'd be good to hear his dulcet tones on the show again.
Yes. So we'll start off by thanking Edward Valio for his generous donation to the show. If you'd like to donate to the show and help keep us trucking along, be sure to go to motopodcast.com, and on the left-hand side of the page there's a donate button. You can donate however much you want, or you can subscribe for there's three different tiers. Put that money into the old Motopod bank account once every month for a year and really help us. Everyone's donation is hugely appreciated, big or small. Every little bit does help. It helped Dave and I obviously go to the MCN show. It'll help Martin in Qatar, and it'll, you know, it just helps with transport and keeping everything running.
It does, yeah. We can't stress just enough how much the donations and the subscriptions really do help us keep this show on the road. So if you guys want to help keep us running, then as Harry says, motopodcast.com, halfway down on the left-hand side, donate or subscribe, and every little bit really does help. So thank you in advance.
Yes, and if you'd like to get in touch with us, you can email us at motopod@motopodcast.com. That goes to all the hosts, even Len now. So be sure to send in any questions, comments, concerns, criticisms, feedback that you may have. We have an email that we'll start with from Nevin Power. Nevin Power usually sends quite long emails, so this one was kind of a welcome relief as a bit of a short one. Didn't have to bust out the old notepad to take notes on it.
No, it was a nice one. When you see you have an email in the inbox from Nevin Power, it's like, okay, we need to book a little bit of time off work to have a look at this one. He sends always very, very much appreciated, Nevin. Thank you so much for all the emails that you do send in, and we do try and reply to you in as in-depth as possible, but your emails certainly rank up there as some of the best that we have for in-depthness. For Nevin, on his email, hi guys, Wayne Gardner sounds like a lot of fun to talk to going on the interview done with him at the London Bike Show by Dave. It was an interesting interview on a few levels to hear about his involvement in the new series for retired racers. It's a great idea, and this is not a criticism of the concept, but do you think such a series is a signal of the demographics of motorcycling right now? I was at the Irish Motorbike and Scooter Show yesterday with a few friends from University College Cork Motorcycle Club. We all noticed the complete lack of people our age, mid to late 20s. Surely this is a worry for the manufacturers, and although the demographics might be healthy in Asia, the retired racers series wouldn't be as big a deal over there. It would be a big deal here in Europe. As such, does that show the way in which the demographics stack up? Sometimes it makes me worried that not enough young people are interested and involved in bikes and bike racing. I know it's not this new series role to solve that, but I do think it signals so etching worrying. All the best to all, and good luck to Harry with his finals.
First of all, thank you, Nevin. Second of all, I think that your point about a different demographics in the Asian market is definitely true. When you look at people who go to the MotoGP races for the Asia rounds, especially Sepang, maybe more so than Metegi and Phillip Island. There are huge amounts of young people, probably under the age of 30, obviously don't know for sure. But any time that, you know, Yamaha or anyone do an event in Indonesia or in Malaysia, there's huge amounts of young people. So I think that it is more of a European, American, I guess, issue that the demographic for motorcycle racing is slightly aging, perhaps.
I agree. And also, when you look at the Asian market, then one of their major forms of transport is the motorcycle, of varying sizes, shapes, and manufacturer.
Mm.
Whereas over in certainly in the UK, speaking from the experience on my side of things, and me being slightly in that demographic of 40 plus, which we'll come on to shortly, and we did touch on it after the chat with Wayne Gardner and the promotional guys for this World GP Legends. When I was sort of 16, 17, 18, and I know it sounds old, and I am, I'm 42, so I have to say, when I was a lad, you know, I've got to say, it sounds dreadful because I'm still 12 in my head. But when we were kids, you know, we had TZR125s, we had KR1Ss, we had RGV250s, we had RD350s, all the two strokes, and the guys were on them straight from school. And nowadays, you don't see so many... the little R125s, the Yamahas, the little Hondas, the little KTMs. You don't see the young kids today of 17, 18, 19, 20 tearing up the streets on the little, I mean, they're only little four strokes now. Not, you don't get the two strokes and the power band and the ring ding and the big expansion chambers that we had. But the demographic is absolutely changing, and Nevin is absolutely spot on in what he says. You know, you look at the guys, it's certainly from the UK perspective, most of the guys you see on motorcycles now tend to be 30 plus. And they're the guys that remember your Freddie Spencers, your Wayne Gardners, your Kevin Schwantz, your Wayne Rainey's, your Eddie Lawson's, etc., McDoohan. And that's where this series will become very popular. And I think because we don't have the youth on the motorcycles in the UK, they've been priced out of the market almost, and the lack of availability from the manufacturers, really, that maybe they're not quite as exciting as they used to be in the motorcycling front, but the kids just don't seem to be getting on the bikes anymore. They seem to be four-wheel based, whether it's an expense thing, whether it's an income thing, I don't know, but it seems to be in the UK turning towards a more expensive hobby.
Yeah, certainly at uni, you barely see any scooters or anything. I mean, in Australia, anytime you see a motorcycle, it'll usually be in the city and usually a businessman commuting. And if it's a motorcycle, it'll usually be like a CBR 500, you know, nothing crazy. Not many sports bikes. Although, having said that, sports bikes do seem to be making a bit more of a comeback. So, I don't know, maybe we will see more young people get in. But yeah, we've kind of talked about this issue before of how do you get young people involved. You know, often when mum and dad drag you somewhere as a young person, you're generally not too enthused by it. I just kind of, I don't know how, say, as I think Dave mentioned it a couple of weeks ago, the idea of, you know, a father dragging their children to one of these GP Legend events, if that would, if the child would be open-minded enough, I guess, to accept it for what it is, or just sit there with their arms crossed the entire time saying, I'd rather be at home.
I mean, when you walk around the BSB paddock, there are so many kids and young lads, and you have a real broad spectrum at BSB. When you look around the paddock and you see who's about, you know, you people you come across through the course of the weekend. But those people aren't necessarily going out and buying the motorbikes on the Monday. You know, they turn up in their cars and they go home in their cars and they spend all week in the cars. They don't actually go out and buy motorcycles, because with the cost of living and everything else these days, from I can only speak from a UK perspective. I'd love to hear something from the American perspective from some of our listeners over the pond to what their take on this side of things is as well, because the World GP Legends will be looking to go over to America, I think, next year. So it may have a similar effect on that side of the pond. Do the youngsters over there ride the bikes, or is it more the sort of late 20s, early 30s, the guys that can afford it? And what really is available on the sports bike package? The old two strokes were almost race derivative. You could either run your RGV 250 on the street, or you could strip it down and race it on the track, couldn't you?
Yeah.
But these days, there isn't that correlation unless you go for an R6, a GSX R600, a Honda CB R600 RR. That's your entry level sports bike almost.
Mm, yeah. Yeah, I don't know. It's how do you get young people interested? Because obviously, TV coverage of things like highlights is fairly limited for MotoGP and motorcycle racing in general. You know, you don't often see a highlight reel on BBC Sport, for instance, whereas you'll see, you know, highlight reels for football constantly. So I don't know. I think there's definitely room for improvement in terms of trying to expand the fan base, especially to a younger audience. Yeah, it'd be interesting to talk to a marketing person from Dorna or from BT Sport or one of the other TV providers to see how they do try and target their programs to try and expand the fan base.
Yeah, I mean, when you see on BT Sport, again, it's obviously UK-based, so for our overseas listeners, I apologise. But on the Tuesday of post-MotoGP weekend, they have MotoGP Tonight. And the bulk of the audience there is made up of 30-plus... British and foreign nationals. As you look around it, it's they tend to be the more mature people that head down there. And whether that's indicative of race fans or what, I don't know. Whether young kids are more into the football, there's a bigger market for football over in the UK, certainly. But Spain seems to manage all right with both.
Yeah.
But motorcycle racing in the UK has always been a niche sport in that respect. And as we were at the show 2 or 3 weeks ago. There was the overwhelming view that there was certainly more of people of my age than yours.
Yep, I could have... there's probably a high chance that if we collected a group of 10 people, I'd probably be the youngest.
I would suggest so. And that's not a good thing.
No, you definitely need a broad fan base, not just in terms of nationalities, but also ages, because, you know, unfortunately, people don't stick around forever. So the people who do remember and who did grow up watching McDoohan, they aren't going to be around forever, and you know we need more people growing up watching Marquez win.
But I think
like
a lot of the people maybe are watching on the TV, and the TV audiences are going all right, and you see the attendance at race circuits, certainly at BSB, MotoGP, not so much World Superbikes in the UK at the minute, but I'm sure that'll come back. But you can pick, you know, 40,000 people on average over a weekend at BSB. You get 60,000-odd at MotoGP ish. I'm going off the top of my head on those figures. I'm not looking at any official results for that. But around about 60,000 maybe at Silverstone. Those people are watching MotoGP and on the TV, and your hours of coverage of BSB and in the States that they get to and in Australia as well. So maybe the TV audiences are healthy and fine, but that's not transposing itself to bums on seats on the road.
Yeah, I don't know. It'll be interesting to watch, and certainly it'll be interesting to see what sort of fans do go to the GP Legends event, if they are mostly older or if we do get a fair few younger people in. If you are a younger motorcycle fan, feel free to write in and, you know, tell us how you got into watching motorcycle racing and if you would be interested in something like the GP Legends. Obviously, we have a bit of a biased fan base, I guess, because if you're listening to a podcast about motorcycle racing, you're obviously in pretty deep and probably know who McDoohan is. And
we have a relatively captive audience, don't we?
Yeah, and you're probably a bit more than just a race day fan.
Yeah. One thing that I spoke to the marketing team about as I was after we'd done the interview with Wayne Gardner for the show, we sort of hung around and chatted a little bit afterwards about the concept behind it and what they were looking to achieve. We spoke about Bennett's Insurance in the UK. One of the biggest motorcycle insurance provider is Bennett's, and they also have their online presence with Bike Social and are making waves in the motorcycle media world as well, for those of you that are online. And recently they've been bought out by a company called Saga, which over in the UK caters for people in their over 50s. It's a sort of a standing joke that once you get to a certain age, you can be insured by Saga, and they do their cruises, and it's aimed at people of a more advanced years than mine at the moment, let's say. But they bought out Bennett's Insurance because 70% of Bennett's clients are over 40. 70% of a motorcycle insurance customer base are over 40.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe we're stressing the correlation between race fan and motorcycle rider too much. I don't know. It's hard to say without any evidence. This is all just kind of anecdotal.
It is, stuff. But I'm sure there's connections there somewhere.
Yeah, for sure. There's probably some sort of correlation. But feel free
to... Wow, that went a bit deep, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. Feel free to write into motopod@motopodcast.com if you are from, from somewhere in Asia, somewhere in America, somewhere in Australia. Obviously, Dave and I are unfortunately kind of just limited to the UK in terms of what we see. So, yeah, feel free to get in touch and tell us what you see or how you view it.
Apologies if that went a little bit deep and a little bit off topic. It's all on point.
we'll bring it back on topic with maybe a bit of a depressing topic for some. The MCN Fantasy League.
No, and let's go straight into the news. over in Spain.
So the MCN Fantasy League pin for Motopod is 19132. You can still join. If you join now, you'll be put to the bottom of the table, but you'll keep your points, and then it'll just slot you in when there's the next race. There were some people who were having a bit of difficulty finding the pin, so that pin again, 19132. Just send that. I'll get an email, and then I will let you in the league. So currently, the league is being led. There's a lot of ties in the league. Obviously, with only one round, there's a lot of tied points. So the top three are currently Mark Crew with Haringworth Hustlers on 98 points, along with Jim Murray with Lobos Losers, and Paul Meadows with Ted 3. Paul Meadows is a name I recognise from the top of the Motopod League, perhaps too much.
The cream always rises to the top.
Exactly. So then we come on to the Hosts Mini League, the hotly contested Hosts Mini League.
And in latest news from Spain.
And we have Martin Darlington leading with the Doha Donuts on 63 points, which is enough for 26th overall. Then I am second with Necessary Faster, 54 points, 82nd overall. Then Jim Race with Race Racing, 31 points, 123rd overall. Then we have a tie for fourth place between Straw Bales Mediocre RT with Dave Neal and Len Padilla, Moto Len, both 21 points, both tied for 144th overall.
Told you I wasn't going to give that wooden spoon up easily.
So that actually transitions quite nicely into the news. And I guess I'll let you take this one since it was kind of your Fantasy League jinx that caused it.
Oh, no, I really am on the verge of withdrawing my team from from the league and just watching you guys go ahead with it. after Jordi Torres at Phillip Island and falling out of race two. Unfortunately, Shane Byrne has broken his hand in testing. They were out at Almeria early this week. The test started on Monday and then Shakey joined on Tuesday. And the rest of the PBM team with Hutchie and with Stuart Easton. Unfortunately, Shakey high-sided at the end of the first day and has broken his hand. He had an operation. One of the knuckles on his left hand was pushed down into his hand and broke a couple of bones. Ooh. So, yeah, not a nice injury to have. And also had a rather large whack to one of his ankles as well. So. Little bit of a sticky start to the season for Shakey. Looks like he'll be out of action for a month, which takes us neatly into the start of the season at round one at Donington Park in almost exactly a month's time. The media reported near high side saved it and then fell off in the gravel, but afterwards Shakey and some of the photos that we've seen suggest that it was a true high side, but on a closed throttle. One or two on social media questioning about traction control, because in BSB traction control is banned, as one of the many rider aids are in our series. But unfortunately, it was on a closed throttle, so traction control wouldn't have made any difference at all. One thing that did come out of that was Milwaukee Yamaha crew chief Mick Shanley did say that maybe a closed loop throttle would have saved it, but. That's a bit beyond my station. Hopefully one or two of you out there will understand what that means. there are whys and wherefores of saving these high sides, but in the main, once it's gone, you ain't getting it back. So get well soon, Shakey. We'll hopefully catch up with him at the test. 3 weeks today for the first full BSB test down at Donington Park, and then the following week, it is round one.
Yep, so hopefully Shakey will be... back and ready. He's already back in the UK, getting some fancy laser treatment on his hand.
Yeah, he's going to get it lasered. He's going in the hyperbaric chamber. And Shaky's not a man to be down for too long. The doctor said 4 weeks. Shaky will not take 4 weeks. He's so much full of determination and grit. Pain is temporary. So I expect him to be back on a bike before, or if not at, the Donington test.
Yep. And someone else who is showing a lot of grit and determination is Troy Bayliss, who is once again racing in World Superbikes, this time at Thailand, for Davide Giuliano. Assen and Aragon haven't been confirmed 100%, but you'd think that he'll probably be at those two rounds. So I think we'll see a stronger result from Bayliss. There was an interesting piece by an Italian journalist, unfortunately I can't remember their name, but it was basically saying that throughout the whole course of the weekend at Phillip Island, Troy Bayliss did about the same amount of laps and distance that riders do in one day of testing. So with that under his belt and some extra hard training, I think that we'll see Bayliss certainly fighting for the top 10.
Certainly. I'm looking forward to seeing him back on a neutral track as well.
Yeah. That will also help, I think, because obviously all the Superbike riders had, you know, 2-3 days of testing at Phillip Island prior to the race, so they all pretty much had their base setting sorted, whereas Bayliss was coming in and, you know, trying to do it raw.
Yeah, and he missed a full session as well, didn't he? So he didn't have the best of weekends for that. There's rumours of another world champion making a reappearance on a motorcycle at a track in the Far East in the summer. There's rumours of Casey Stoner that he'll be racing Suzuka this year, obviously for Honda. He did actually test the production Fireblade at a recent Sepang test. So if Suzuka is just floating around as a rumor at the moment, why was it even there? He's never been a production racer. So It's just interesting that they just happened to have a Honda Fireblade there.
I think it was specifically the Suzuka Honda Fireblade as well. The full Suzuka spec one.
I didn't know that. That's cool. Okay, so even more so then that for somebody who's has he ever raced Suzuka before? Did he race it previously?
Not that I can remember. No, I think that Suzuka was before Stoner's time. I'd have to go back and double check.
That'll be interesting to see. I'd like to see him on a production bike and just see what he can do on that.
Yeah, and the Bridgestone tires for Suzuka are pretty close to MotoGP tires from everything that I've heard. So that's slightly one less thing you'd have to worry about. And I'm sure that he'd still probably go pretty well, regardless of knowing the bike or not. So yeah, I hope he does race. It'd be cool. It would be excellent to see him race again. But just one that we'll have to wait and see. Stoner certainly isn't one to announce it on Facebook like Troy Bayliss did with his his second comeback.
No, that's right. With the picture of him in his leather saying, see you soon. Which was all the indication for Thailand that we needed.
Yep, exactly. Stefano Manzi, he unfortunately won't be racing at Qatar in the Moto3 class for the San Carlo Team Italia team, as he's unfortunately too young. Fabio Quartararo, he gets past the young rule, as we've talked about, as there's the special Fabio clause, where if you're SEV champion, you're exempt from the age rule. So, unfortunately, Manzi will be missing a race because he's just too young, but we will still get to see Fabio out there in Qatar. I'm very excited about that.
It didn't hold Jorge Lorenzo back because he wasn't allowed to race. Was it Jerez because he was too young? He had to wait until his 15th birthday?
He had to miss the first day of practice.
Yeah.
Yep, exactly.
It didn't hold him back either. So.
Nope, he eventually came good, certainly.
Yes. The Open Ducatis have seamless gearboxes. Thanks to Bernie Summers for flagging this one up via email to us on an article on Speedweek. It appears that not only will Yamaha and Honda have the seamless gearboxes, but Ducati open bikes too.
Yeah, and this is kind of a big thing because there was some worry that the spec electronics wouldn't quite work with the seamless gearbox, but it seems like Ducati have worked some sort of black magic, and they have now gotten the seamless gearbox to work with the open bike, which is a pretty big step for Ducati. And a pretty big step overall. So it'll be interesting to see if the Honda open bikes do get seamless gearboxes throughout the year, if that's an upgrade that Honda want to give, or it'll just be interesting to wait and see for 2016, as we've kind of touched on before with the whole new tires and new electronics thing.
Yes, it's all aiming towards 2016, isn't it? I think everybody will be running it by the start of next season, at least.
Bit of unfortunate news. The JR BMW Racing team that was going to be run by Troy Corsa, they will not be participating in World Superbike this year, thus leaving Tony Elias and Artin Badovini out of a ride. It basically seems like the team communications with BMW broke down, so the team never even received any BMW Superbikes. They obviously weren't at any of the testing, weren't at Phillip Island, so things were already looking, unfortunately, grim. And, yeah, this is the final nail in the coffin that they won't be participating in any World Superbike races. So, it's pretty crazy that, you know, the first Moto2 world champion in Tony Elias doesn't have a ride. Sure, he's had some tough years, but maybe he'll be able to pick up a replacement ride somewhere.
Let's hope so. It'd be good to see him back on a bike. As you say, as a former world champion, he deserves something a little bit better.
Hmm.
Over in Misano, they're resurfacing the track. They're putting down a special formula asphalt enough to combat the salty sea air with it being so close to the Adriatic at Rimini. Thanks to GP Bry for dropping that down to us. It's the only track that is so close to the sea, isn't it? So it's just interesting that they have to put a special formula together for salty sea air. You wouldn't have thought it would have had too much of an effect.
Yeah, well, it certainly... Misano, I think there were 130 crashes or something like that, give or take a couple.
Certainly on the Friday when it was wet.
Yeah, especially in the wet. Misano was kind of famous for being like an ice skating ring, just super slippery. And yeah, there were just huge amounts of crashes there last year, so it was definitely needed for a resurface. I'm surprised that Phillip Island doesn't have a similar issue with the sea air. Phillip Island obviously has a certain other issues with tires and things like that.
Looking to go on to.
Mm.
That has the opposite effect on tires. That rips them to pieces.
Yeah, but that's obviously slightly more because of the track layout. Maybe I don't really understand how winds work. So maybe the winds blow away from Phillip Island or something. So therefore the sea air doesn't get brought onto the track. I don't know.
Ooh, now we're getting into the meteorological bounds now.
Yeah, I think we're stepping above our station a bit with that one. If anyone is a meteorologist, be sure to write in and tell us how air works. I think El Nino, I think that's something to do with winds. I don't know.
It is, but that's over towards Mexico and the Pacific, isn't it? Which way are the prevailing winds at Phillip Island? If anybody knows, please get in touch.
Yeah, onto something that we do know a bit more about, the Sepang test. Specifically, we'll start with the Michelin test because there's not quite as much information to go on about that. All the riders are still sworn to secrecy over what they think of the Michelin tyres because Bridgestone still has their tyre contract with the MotoGP Championship. Again, we saw a fair few crashes, very fast crashes, certainly. Jorge Lorenzo, Alicia Spargo, Andrea Dovizioso, all three of them crashed. Lorenzo's bike got turned pretty much into a trials bike as the entire subframe and seat unit got ripped clean off.
Yes, expensive times. Who foots the bill for that? The teams or Michelin?
I'm not sure. I'd imagine it's the teams.
I would too. Makes you wonder, doesn't it, that they're testing the tyres and if it crashes, then maybe what they call that pilot error or they're trying to develop something. It just makes you wonder who foots the bill for that. It turn five, wasn't it? Which really, very, really fast turn at Sepang. One thing that we seem to have gleaned from the test and from the potential for the crashes, that it's that they Michelin have developed a super sticky rear, which unfortunately it seems from what we can glean from various reports and observations that from Sepang and beyond, that it may well push the front a little bit too much, that the rear is generating a little bit too much grip.
Yeah, that and the riders just aren't used to the different front. They're obviously probably still trying to ride it a bit like a Bridgestone. Haven't had enough time to adapt. So, yeah, certainly Michelin have maybe a bit of work to do on the front tyre, maybe not so much on the rear.
And historically, a Michelin front isn't quite at the same standard or is a completely different feel to a Bridgestone front.
Yeah, but I have every faith that Michelin will be able to sort the tyres. And when it comes to testing next year with the full Michelin tyres, we won't have kind of all similar crashes. I'm sure there'll still be crashes because it's testing and racing motorcycles.
Yes.
But I think that they'll obviously improve. They have a huge amount of time and Michelin have already, you know, they've already done multiple tests, some private, some slightly more public. So I have every faith that they'll be able to get closer
Oh, no question. No question whatsoever, which is why they're testing now, some 12 months and more before the first race kicks off. So they have plenty of data and plenty to come back with.
Yep. Also, there were some unofficial lap times released from journalists with the cheeky stopwatch, and it seems like the top guys were running in about the two-minute area with the Michelin tyres, which is, you know, one and a half seconds off what the very, very top guys were doing in testing.
Which isn't too much of a drop-off, really. You know, for coming back into it from a base level, and only the second or third official test of what they're actually going to be working towards for next year, I think that's comfortably what you would say within the ballpark.
Yeah, it's certainly a very good base to work off. You know, obviously the bikes and the riders are still set up for the Bridgestones, so they're not at 100%, the tyres aren't at 100%, and to already be within the two-minute mark, that's excellent. You know, the two-minute mark is about what Hector Barbero was doing in testing to get into the top 10, and that was obviously with the super soft Bridgestones, as he's an open bike.
Yes, well, it's all boding well for the future. That's good.
Yeah.
Look forward to seeing what they bring to the next test and what we can glean from that.
Yep, it'll also be interesting to see how Bridgestone react in this last year, if Bridgestone do kind of throw everything in the kitchen sink at their tyres to just try and, set almost impossible lap records to beat.
Well, that's going to be the legacy they want to leave behind, isn't it?
Mm.
That they can, you know, you look at the lap records and then going forward to next year, at least at the end of this year, set the fastest laps ever around each circuit that were all on Bridgestones before we go to year zero next year.
As we keep saying, it's a lot of wait and see. Hopefully throughout the year, maybe it's somewhere like the Bruno test, we'll get some official lap times released so we can start to see that. I'm not 100% sure how the Bridgestone tyre contract is laid out. Kind of doubtful that we'll get to see any lap times from...
I don't think we'll get to see any lap times until Sepang next year.
Yeah, hopefully some more journalists get some more accurate stopwatches and we can try and delve into the data a bit. But things are certainly looking bright for the future. We have seamless gearboxes working with spec electronics. We have tyres that aren't too much different. We have a lot of young up-and-coming riders, so the future's looking good.
Absolutely. Speaking of speculative data, we have the race replicant, the race, what's the word I'm looking for?
Simulation.
That's the word. You can tell I've been on nights because everything's just a little bit foggy and fuzzy. We have the race simulation times that you kindly posted up for us on the show notes. They do actually make for interesting reading once you've sussed out by only having 4 hours sleep how they actually work and what the information's showing. The race runs that the guys did at Sepang last week, it shows a lot of the consistency, and it groups together the laps that the guys did. So rather than just posting the times at the end of the session, this has a full list of every lap that they do, whether it's 59 laps, 58 laps, 65 in the case of Marc Marquez. And it also groups together the little lap times that they do. So you can see when they've done a race simulation, what sort of times they're running at. Now, when we take the reigning world champion, Marc Marquez, for example, on his very last run of the day, on the third day?
Yep, there's looking at the third day.
Yep, from the third day, lap 54 to 65, he lapped 2:07, or between 2 minutes dead and 2:07 for 11 laps.
Yeah, that's super consistent, and that's also, it's faster than last year's race pace by a significant margin.
Wasn't it 30 seconds or something? If he'd kept that pace, it'd have been 30 seconds quicker, something like that?
Yeah, something like that. As Cal Crutchlow pointed out on Twitter, is that all the race simulations in testing are kind of always a fair bit faster than the actual race pace. So, obviously...
Which is understandable because there's no overtakes.
Yep, exactly. And there's no overtakes. There's no trying to avoid other riders.
Exactly. No defensive riding if somebody's trying to bite back at you. So, yeah, it's understandable. But the actual continuous pace... To say, okay, Mark, there you go, there's your track, go and lap. It's frighteningly consistent.
Yes. Also, Mark's top lap times are frighteningly quick. As we mentioned, Marquez is the first ever rider into the 158s.
Yes.
At Sepang. You know, usually if you did a 159, you were pretty insanely quick. But Marquez has once again raised the bar and has now put in a 158.8. 8.67.
Traditionally at Sepang, when you look at testing, the idea was that, you know, if you could do a sub 2 minute, that would mean you were on the pace and up the sharp end of the timetables. Mm. And I mean sub 2 minutes, as in 159.9, 159.7, around that sort of mark. But heading down to the early 159s and dipping into the 158s is just a phenomenal pace.
Yeah, certainly. And combining the times from Sepang 1 and Sepang 2, all of the top nine riders, that's Marquez, Pedrosa, Iannone, Rossi, Lorenzo, Crutchlow, Espargaro, Dovizioso, and Bradley Smith, all nine of those guys were in the 159s, well, apart from Marquez, who's in the 158s. But that's, yeah, that's all super quick. And then everyone in the top 18 was 2 minutes or under, which, yeah, the pace is certainly certainly hotting up. That's for
it's
sure.
Certainly shown the level of the pace, hasn't it, in MotoGP, that now you have to look, you have to lap considerably under 2 minutes to be anywhere near the sharp end with the guys at the front.
Yeah, I think that the pole position shootout will be incredible to watch at Sepang this year. Obviously, they already have all that data from the two tests, and then they'll have all the data from working throughout the year. And yeah, you usually see some pretty crazy times during qualifying at Sepang. So maybe we'll see Pedrosa or Iannone or someone join Marquez in the 158s. I'm almost certain we won't get a 157, but with Marquez, you can't really rule anything out.
No. One thing that's interesting between the two Sepang best times, when they compare Sepang 1 to Sepang 2, the track conditions were slightly different on the second visit to the circuit.
Mm.
And almost it's almost as though the timesheets are upside down. When you, courtesy of Moto Matters, who's gone to the considerable trouble of putting the times together and comparing the two, the guys who were towards the front, your Dani Pedrosas, your Valentino Rossis, Marc Marquez, all were slower on the second visit. Yeah. I know that it's testing and there are different parameters, and obviously Yamaha had the full seamless gearbox at the second test. But Jorge Lorenzo did better his time by 0.187 over the first week. But Rossi was nearly half a second slower. Dani Pedrosa was nearly a second slower. Loris Baz almost a second slower on the forward Yamaha as well. But good progression from the rest of the guys. Jack Miller going 0.3 quicker. Eugene Laverty going half a second quicker. Looking towards a mid-top 10, Bradley Smith picked up half a second. And Cal Crutchlow, one of the bigger winners, with a 0.878 improvement over the first session.
Yep.
There.
That was his first ever 159 lap, he said. So he's definitely getting to grips with the Honda. As people will probably remember, on the Tech 3 bike, he put in some incredible qualifying results. Crutchlow is certainly one who can pull out that one fast lap, you know. He'd often crash, come in, get on the second bike, and still manage to put it on the front two rows with just one lap. Perhaps the most surprising in terms of improvement was Hector Barbera, who was 0.9 quicker, and Carol Abraham, who was 0.7 quicker, almost 0.8 quicker, in fact.
With a toe or without a toe?
Of course with a toe. Of course with a toe.
It was the subject of much chagrin and abuse on social media.
Yeah, both of them seem to have gotten perhaps even worse at waiting for a toe. Carol Abrahams came under fire from both Cal Crutchlow and Scott Redding. Cal Crutchlow showing Carol Abraham his middle finger.
And showed you who was number one.
Yep, and I think Scott Redding actually may have shoved Carol Abraham at the side of the track a bit. Because Abraham was, he'd be, you know, middle of the track just waiting for a toe, and just constantly waiting for a toe. If you remember, I think it was at one of the Mugello tests a couple of years ago, Carol Abraham did a similar thing to Casey Stoner, which resulted in Casey Stoner storming over to Carol Abraham's box, and probably would have decked him if there hadn't been a lot of much bigger mechanics around.
Yes, it's notorious, the pair of them. But, you know, get out there and do the laps yourself. You're not going to learn anything just by following somebody who's quicker than you, who's going to disappear after five or six corners. And you're just going to get them riled up and get in their face, and it's just not conducive. So just try and do your own times. Easy for me to say, sat here in my...
Yeah, exactly.
It's easy for me to say, sat here in my little office, and yeah. So, yes, I do appreciate that there are ways and means and things that these guys need to do.
But yeah, I think that Hector Barbera is by far the best caravan in MotoGP. He seems to be able to, you know, make the toe work incredibly well for him. and maybe we see him on the front two rows on that open Ducati with a bit of a tow, if someone does let him get a tow.
And the thickest skinned MotoGP rider as well.
Yeah, yeah. when was it? I think it was 2, maybe 3 years ago. Lorenzo had a special sign for his pit board, specifically for when Barbera was having a tow. I think it was like a tricycle or something, or maybe it was a caravan. Right.
I think it was it was either the tricycle or it was the actual caravan, wasn't it? I can't remember which one it was. There was something special there.
So, yeah, I guess that's at least Hector Barbera's claim to fame.
Very much so.
Just kind of Marco Melandri's continuing struggles. He was 4.7 seconds off the pace when you combine the two Sepang's lap times. But it does look like he'll be staying with Aprilia. Aprilia have issued, you know, several statements saying, we believe in Marco, you know, we understand that he's, you know, maybe not the mentally, his mental strength isn't right up there at the moment, but we believe he can come good. So, yeah.
He took to social media, didn't he, to say, I'm really sorry, I just can't ride it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Len and I...
unprecedented step.
Yeah, Len and I briefly touched on that last week that, you know... Yeah. It was one of the first times you've ever seen a ride. You know, usually it's just the same old stuff of just, oh yeah, you know, we pushed very hard, we got a good lap time, you know, there's still work to do, yada, 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 all that sort of stuff. But Marco Melandri just straight up said, you know, can't ride the thing. So.
Fair play to him for his honesty. Yeah. Whether it, you know, in this modern day of the PR androids, it's nice to have a little bit of honesty, which is why Cal's always good for a little bit of a soundbite.
Yeah, certainly. So, we'll have to wait and see what happens with Melandri. Who knows? Just have to wait and see. It was good to see Alicia Spargo in 11th, 1.4 seconds off the pace on the Suzuki. I think there'll certainly be a points contender. Vinales was 15th, and I think that we might see Spargo fighting for that top 10. You know, he was behind Barbera. I'm pretty sure that Spargo could beat Barbera in a straight race without a tow. So,
More consistent improvement from Maverick Vinales as well.
Yep, and also the Ducatis, both the Andreas were very happy with the new GP15. They said that it's the first Ducati that they've ridden that actually turns. So certainly that problem's been fixed. It'll be interesting to see if they can get that win they're searching for. I think that if there's a wet weather race, Dovizioso will certainly be on for a win. Unfortunately, wet weather races don't count towards the removal of the fuel and tire.
What is the rule on that? Is that a dry podium or a dry win?
It's 3 dry thirds, 2 dry seconds, or a dry win.
And they revert to factory standards.
I think first they slightly reduce the fuel,
right,
and the tires, and then they have to take 3 wins to become full factory or something like that. I'll look it up properly.
So it's not an immediate return to factory conditions.
No, there's an intermittent step.
Okay. Interesting. Thank you for that. I just want to clear that up. A little bit one of those grey areas, isn't it? It's like, well, what does actually happen at this point? Do they go back to full factory settings? Do they become a full factory team? Or is it, like you say, in a staged way? Which makes more sense.
Yeah, certainly. And there's a lot of things like that. Like just quickly going back to the Troy Bayliss thing. If Troy Bayliss does do Assen and Aragon, he'll have ridden in 4 races, which means he won't be a replacement rider, but he'll be a full-time rider. So therefore, he gets a separate engine allocation to Davide Giuliano, but the rules in World Superbike are still pretty unclear on that. So that's another thing that had people kind of scratching their heads and asking a lot of questions about. Because Bayliss, unfortunately, did blow up an engine at Phillip Island, and obviously engine allocations are pretty tight in all championships.
But when it's not Giuliano that's riding it, then you have to... I mean, there are times when you have to adapt the rules to the situation.
If Bayliss is a replacement rider and therefore riding on Giuliano's allocation or what, yet again, I feel like I'm always saying it, we'll have to wait and see.
But we do. That's just the nature of the game, isn't it? It's the nature of racing.
Yep.
We don't have the answers. We have to wait and see what transpires. And as soon as we find out, we'll bring that news to you.
Yep. And there's a little more testing. BSB out in Spain, testing at a variety of tracks.
Yeah, as is usual at this time of year, either at Almeria, Cartagena, Guadix, a lot of the guys out now ahead of the BSB season, as we said earlier, that starts in about 4 weeks' time. There's been a pro-test down at Almeria with focused events. Quattro Plant were there. The rookie Luke Mossy was fastest, ahead of friend of the show, build-based BMW rider Lee Jackson. Not too many teams in attendance, as GB Moto, Tyco BMW, WD-40 and Halsall Suzuki are out at Cartagena as we speak. One guy that was missing from the test is Ryuichi Kiyonari, the runner-up from last year and three-time British Superbike champion. He's still out in Japan with visa issues, so he hasn't made the trip home, or back across from home, should I say, as yet. So missing out on valuable track time at the moment. However, with Shaky's injury and with the Milwaukee Yamahas not actually turning a wheel until next week, they're not missing out on too much time on the front three from last year, but there's no replacement for track time, so he needs to get that resolved as soon as possible. The team don't seem to think it's much of an issue. It's more of a paperwork thing, so hopefully Keo will be with the team next week and to get some laps turned ahead of the season.
Yeah, that is one interesting thing. Obviously, since the Superstock bikes don't race at Phillip Island in World Superbike, we still haven't really seen the new R1, you know, on track in any sort of competitive or testing nature.
Not at all.
The Graves team in the US have been doing a fair bit of testing, but there's not been any lap times for that, so there's not been anything to compare it to. Josh Brooks had a bit of a ride around on the R1 at the Eastern Creek launch of the Superbike, but there's still a big question mark over, you know, what it's like.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing that people are waiting with bated breath most. It's the first from the ground up super brand new superbike we've had for a couple of 3 years now.
Yeah,
absolutely. But I was thinking of what runs in BSB more than anything.
Yeah.
The Moto Rapido Panigale is a beautiful piece of kit, but it's not quite running towards the front, which I expect that to change this year with Kuba Smertz and Wilf Moore and his efforts from Moto Rapido. There's been so much hype and media attention on the R1 and the R1M that we're still waiting to see what it can do. I mean, you look at social media feeds and people, there's an awful lot of expectation, certainly from Milwaukee Yamaha, who... rumor would have it, if they have a successful season, will be one of the official World Superbike teams for next year. I think that's certainly the aim of Sean Muir and the team, to go for that accolade next year, if you like, to be the Yamaha team in World Superbikes. They've only just taken delivery of the new R1s for 2015, which were built out in Germany under the watchful eyes of Mick Shanley, who's a crew chief for Josh Brooks, and Steve Bradley, who's crew chief to Brock Parks. And also the Superstock bikes have been delivered as well, which I think Adam Jenkinson was there, so maybe he will be riding that. He'll swap to Yamaha machinery this year from Kawasaki from last year. So it'd be interesting to see once the Yamaha boys, once both Brock and Josh get out on track, and see what times, if any, are released on what times the journos can take from the tests. I know Simon Patterson from MCN's out in Spain at the minute, as is Ollie Rushby from Bennett. So if those guys are around in the UK next week, if that's where the testing will be, then hopefully we'll have some times to bring you, and at least some pictures to add to the show notes as well. So
yeah.
From the launch a couple of weeks ago, just before we went to the show, mid-Feb, the bike looks fantastic, but we're yet to see it, as you rightly say, in the flesh.
Yeah, and that's the other thing, is that even though the Thailand round of World Superbikes coming up, again, Superstock don't race there, so it probably will be those BSB tests where we get the first real comparison of the R1 versus, you know, some other superbikes.
They must be really confident to leave it this late for a brand new bike.
Yeah.
Because in the grand scheme of things, it is quite late.
Yeah, exactly. But who knows, there's a lot of smoke and daggers in motorcycle racing, so...
There certainly is. Young Jordan Weaven, he's been out at Almeria this week at the same test as the Superbike boys, getting his first laps on board the Russo Racing NMT Cargo No Limits Track Days Kawasaki. His first step up onto a big bike from the KTM Moto 3. 66 laps, he was 9 seconds off on his first couple of circuits, and by the end of the first day, he was 4.5 seconds off.
So, 5 seconds improvement, pretty decent.
That's not bad, is it? It's not bad. The young boy's doing well, so we'll be following that with a lot of closeness, obviously for my own personal interest with Jordan. But it'd be it's the first time that I'll have been with someone to experience going from a small race focused prototype to a nice, comfy, soft production 600 Kawasaki.
Yeah, we'll definitely have to get him on again to share his thoughts on how the adjustment's going and some of the bigger challenges of swapping up the sizes.
Not something we hear very often, and it's becoming more the norm. And from not only the UK, but as you touched on with Neil Morrison on social media earlier in the week about Red Bull rookies headed into European Superstock.
Mm.
With the lack of funds and availability of rides, that's almost getting the way forward now, that people are making the jump from the little KTM 250s or the Honda 250s, whatever they've been riding, onto production 600s on cut slicks rather than the sticky Dunlops.
Yep.
So there's a lot to take into account on that. So could be interesting. We'll have a word with Jordan on that once he gets up to speed and have a chat with him and see what it's been like for him to make that change. Obviously, as a former Red Bull rookie as well.
Yeah, MotoGP.com also have a very good video with Alex Marquez about the differences in cornering on a Moto3 and a Moto2 machine. So if you do have the MotoGP.com video pass, it's very good value for money. You should go buy it. Be sure to check that video out. And, he does a drawing. It's very easy to see. So, I thought that was a very good video. And, yeah, just check it out.
That's something that Jordan's been working through this week with his rider coach, Ewan Burnett, is lines. He knows how to ride a bike. It's the difference in lines and the difference in how he approaches the track that's the biggest learning curve for him. He knows which way the gears go. He knows how to ride the bike, but how to ride it on track and ride it fast, that's the art he's looking to learn.
Well, hopefully he goes well. And hopefully we can bring you more updates on Jordan and all the other testing next week. But I think that's pretty much a show for us.
It is, yeah. Again, my apologies if I'm a little bit woolly and a little bit on the fluffy side after a night shift. But we do what we can to bring you guys a show each week and not to leave Harry high and dry on his own with the other guys being busy off doing their things. Good news on the gym front. He's going well in the US. He sends his best regards to everybody. He is still out there. And hopefully in the not too distant future, he will return to the show and can fill us in on where he's been, what he's doing, and his worthwhile views on all things motorcycle racing. And obviously we will have Martin Darlington back on the show from Qatar in the next week or so.
Yep. So, yep, look forward to that. And hopefully we can bring you some more interviews in the next coming weeks. And hopefully there's some news for next week, because otherwise it might be a bit of a short show.
Yeah, we don't want to be going down the roads of demographics and things like we did earlier on. So apologies if we glazed over at that little bit earlier on when we got slightly sidetracked. But that does happen from time to time. Interesting thoughts. And again, if you do have any feedback, motopod@motopodcast.com. Join the debate. Let us know what you think and what correspondence we receive. We will discuss on air.
Yep, and that's the show. So we'll catch everyone next week. It's a bye from me.
Yep, I'm off to get some tea, and I'm going to head back to work. So, and bye from me too. Thanks, everyone. Catch you soon.
Bye.
Bye.